Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
Good to have another show.
Yeah.
We have begun a wonderful section of history with talking about some incredible people.
Yeah.
And we're going to continue that today?
We're going to do some more of that today.
Okay.
And we're going to end with some bloodshed,
though. Okay.
There's another side to what's going on, besides the fact that there's so many just incredible saints. Also, there's a tremendous threat in the Mediterranean, especially with the Ottoman Turks and the spread of Islam and that challenge. And so we'll be looking at that. It's probably the only time that we're actually going to take apart an actual battle.
Oh, okay.
The Battle of Lepanto.
Oh,
it's an
great,
incredibly important battle. And I think it'd be good for us to take the elements apart and take a look at that particular battle. So we'll be starting out with some saints like St. Philip Neri and end with big military conflict.
All right. So. Well, we're on Earth. Nothing wonderful lasts forever, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah. But this thing about saints really does. You have, at the beginning of the 1500s, you have a number of saints, which we could just call super saints.
Right.
You know, the big names, Thomas More, John Fisher, Angela Merici, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Ignatius of Loyola. And it doesn't stop there. The next generation comes right along, and especially Ignatius of Loyola. I mean, if you start following the saints over the next 150 years that have SJ after their name, is just absolutely incredible. So so then you have the second tier, which
the
we talked
impact,
about
right.
last time around. St. Cajetan with mm-hmm. the founding of the Oratory. and then also Jerome Emiliani, Pope Pius V, Francis Xavier, Francis Borgia, Charles Borromeo, Philip Neri, you know, and then we go into yet another generation. Remember that we sort of gathered all of these around 1517,
right.
which is the date of the nailing of the 95 Theses. Mm-hmm. And so we can see that there were saints alive at that time, and some of them were very young. Philip Neri was 2 years old at the time.
Right.
But, and then we said we were going to then take another date, 1571, so reversing the 17 and mm-hmm. making it a 71. This is the year of the Battle of Lepanto.
Okay.
And then looking at saints who were alive at that time. And once again, just a bunch. You've got Camillus of Lellis, Lawrence of Brindisi, Franciscan, Peter Canisius,
mm-hmm.
Robert Bellarmine, Stanislaus Kostka, Benedict the Moor. And along with these, also, you've got Francis de Sales. And he sort of like introduces us into the next wave, which will take us into the 1600s, especially with his work with Jane Frances de Chantal
mm-hmm.
and the establishment of the Visitation Order in France. And then we're going to see like bunches of saints in the 1600s, and especially in France. Probably, undoubtedly, the best known is St. Vincent de Paul. But there'll be many others also. So this is just a really exciting period of church history. There is truly a Catholic Reformation underway. People will talk about it as being the Counter-Reformation, but as we have seen time after time, the Catholic Reformation got started before 1517 and was continuing during and after 1517.
Great.
So why don't we go ahead and start then right away with Philip Neri. It's a good one to take a look at. He was 2 years old, as I mentioned, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses.
Mm-hmm.
He was 56 years old at the time of the Battle of Lepanto. So
okay.
he is in the midst of both of these groups of saints. And he will not die until 1595. At the age of 80 years old, he sees
wow.
a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know that he almost spans that whole century, a good portion of that century. You know, it's one of those deals again where saints bring out saintliness in other saints. He was the spiritual director of Saint Camillus.
Oh, okay.
That's something.
Wow.
And there's an interesting juncture in all of this. St. Camillus is really quite interesting in himself. Here's a man who as I say, is a spiritual directee of St. Philip Neri. St. Camillus is from Chieti. Now, remember, that's an interesting city over on the Adriatic Sea, because that's the city where Bishop Carafa, John Pietro Carafa, eventually Pope Paul IV, is from. This is the city where St. Cajetan was, that the founding of the Oratory of the Divine Love was there. The Theatine Fathers is all going to be there. St. Camillus was a soldier, and led a pretty soldierly kind of a life. His younger life was just as wild as anybody's. In fact, he's something of the patron saint of gamblers.
Oh, really?
Who is known for being such a gambler. However, he had an experience in which, he ended up very sick, ended up in the hospital, and hospitals back then were basically places for people to die, not to get better, and it really changed his life. And so he went off then to try to join the Capuchins. And remember, once again, this is so significant, because the Capuchins are a relatively new off-branch of the Franciscans that had been brought about through the efforts of Matteo de Bassio to renew the Franciscan fervor. And then with that, he also has two very wonderful, holy and devout women who are helping him, that being Caterina Sebo, a niece of several popes, the two popes, and Vittoria Colonna.
Right, Colonnas.
Yeah, one of those Colonnas again, yeah. That's an incredible family. They've been around for centuries. They're still around, by the way.
Right.
And not only over in Corsica. You know, we have that case of that of that guy in Corsica that was arrested recently
right.
by the French government, you know, on an assassination charge. But also the Colonna family is still in Rome, is still very much involved with the Knights of Malta.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit, we'll talk a lot about the Knights of Malta, because they really play a very important role in this century. But... yeah, so they're still around. That's something.
That is. It's really.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Camillus was rejected by the Capuchins. They thought he was a little bit too wild, and so he didn't get in. But instead, he founds his own order, and to care for orphans and for the infirmed, and. He eventually is going to be ordained a priest, and his order will be made up of priests. It's a small order. And they've got the unfortunate title of, named after Camillus, the Camillians. Okay, not the reptile. But, yeah. Another contemporary with Camillus, living at the same time, was accepted by the Capuchins. And his name is Lawrence of Brindisi.
Okay.
He is an incredible linguist. You know, for those of us who study to learn a foreign, just a slave to try to learn a foreign language, and all, you just have to be jealous of these guys. He obviously speaks Italian. It was his native language. He picked up then French, German, is fluent in both, Greek, Hebrew, and Syriac.
Wow.
That's something. A wonderful preacher. Later on, becomes provincial of the of a province. In fact, a couple of different provinces in northern Italy, and provincial of the Capuchins in Switzerland. Also, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but around in 1601, the Ottoman Turks were invading Hungary. We're going to go back and look at the Turks. They've been at it since the late 1400s, running around invading places. And during his lifetime, he finds himself in a situation which he was asked by the Capuchins to intercede with the Holy Roman Emperor to raise an army in order to defend the Christians of Hungary.
Lawrence of Brindisi was?
Lawrence of Brindisi. This is not an easy task for him to do. The reason for that is that the emperor is at the time is Rudolf II, And he reigns from 1576 to 1612, but around 1601, he became a recluse.
Uh-huh.
And he would not see anyone, very few people. He lived in, the emperor took up residence in Prague, Rädchen Castle. If you ever see a picture of Prague, you always see Rädchen Castle.
Okay,
The big, beautiful castle. Anyway, that's where he took up residence and would only allow very few people to see him. But some of them were pretty influential characters. One of those was the astronomer Tycho Brahe. And then also Johannes Kepler was also among those who he entertained. And then he had a whole bunch of weirdos. Remember that this is the age of Nostradamus, too.
Oh, okay.
And so he's dealing with all of this kind of stuff. So the fact of the matter is that Lawrence of Brindisi had a terrible, terrible task of getting the empire to back a crusade in order to defend the Hungarians. He succeeds in doing it by going directly to the German princes themselves. And he's able to raise an army with the emperor's permission, but you know the emperor wasn't involved in this at all, and acts as a chaplain and saves Hungary at that point.
Wow.
You know, later on, then, he goes back the next year in 1602 and becomes the master general of the superior of the Capuchins himself, and will continue doing that for a number of years. He dies at the age of 60 in Lisbon, Portugal, while visiting the Capuchins there.
Hmm.
So, just a tremendous influence. Another one of his contemporaries at the same time is a Jesuit who is also a polyglot. This is a guy who speaks many languages.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Peter Canisius.
Oh.
And Peter Canisius is Dutch. He's born in Nijmegen in the Netherlands. At the time, the Netherlands was still under Spanish control, so it was the Spanish Netherlands. Joins the Jesuits and is sent off to the University of Cologne to study there. Remember that this is where Thomas Aquinas had studied.
Right.
You know, this is where St. Albertus Magnus had taught many centuries earlier, but, you know, a great center of learning. And so he himself studies there, then goes to the Louvain to study and then to teach ultimately. And he is tapped by one of the cardinal archbishops at the Council of Trent to go as his peritus, as his expert. And this is going to be the Archbishop of Augsburg will take Peter Canisius to Trent. There'll be several very prominent Jesuits at Trent acting as theologians. and here we have Peter Canisius involved in that. Later then, St. Ignatius of Loyola himself called Peter Canisius to Rome. And then from Rome, he was sent to Sicily, where he spent a couple years there, and then was then sent to Germany, where he spent the rest of his life.
Hmm.
And in part of that Jesuit effort to reconvert the Germans back to Catholicism, mm-hmm. Peter Canisius is known in German history as the second Boniface.
Oh, really?
Because there were so many reconversions from Lutheranism and from some of the other cults that were, you know, the Anabaptists and, you know, the followers of Münster and all those people, back to Catholicism through the efforts of Canisius and others. He spent 30 years in Germany.
Wow.
Teaching and preaching and renewing, acting as provincial throughout much of that. After the Council of Trent was over, it is Peter Canisius who really puts together the Catechism, which will be such an important teaching tool. That Catechism, within a couple of years, is going to go through 55 editions.
Wow.
Literally a dozen languages and 55 editions. Ultimately, before the Catechism that we have today, and all the as we went into the 19th and 20th century, ultimately that catechism is going to have 200 editions.
Wow, that's incredible.
Isn't that? Yeah, yeah. Peter Canisius was had an energy that just would not give up. At the age of 70, he had a debilitating stroke, and he was no longer able to speak. And even then, He had a secretary working with him, and he continued writing and publishing, even after this debilitating stroke, by being able to communicate with the secretary so that the secretary could then go ahead and write out the words that Canisius could no longer speak.
Wow.
But it just never gave up.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another contemporary with Peter Canisius is going to be St. Robert Bellarmine, once again also a Jesuit. And he's born in 1542. His uncle is a cardinal, Cardinal Sorvino, Marcellus Sorvino.
Okay.
He is elected pope. Mm-hmm. He chooses his own name as in the title, and so he becomes Marcellus II. If you remember, he's the 3-week pope.
Okay.
Dies. The only thing that happens during his reign, of course, is that that Palestrina writes a mass for him.
That's right.
But he dies shortly after. In 1560, Robert Bellarmine joined the Jesuits and then studied, and afterwards also, like Peter Canisius, taught at the Louvain, taught there for 6 years from 1570 to 1576, and then was made provincial of Naples. Was then tapped as a cardinal. Did a lot of writing. And some of his most interesting writing had to do with the relationship between church and state, which was kind of interesting. His ideas are quite remarkable. What he argues is that that the originator of all authority is God, mm-hmm. of course. And then he argues that the authority that God has over the affairs of the world is vested in the people. And the people then entrust that authority to fit rulers. This is the opposite of the divine right theory, where later on, particularly, you're going to see this in the 17th and 18th century, where kings and a number of churchmen, Bossuet being the most famous, is going to argue that authority comes from God and goes directly to the king, who then mm-hmm. has the duty to oversee and rule justly a people. Whether he does justly or not is another question. But here's Robert Bellarmine taking a much more democratic approach, mm-hmm. that the authority is in the hands of the people, which is then entrusted to a ruler. He doesn't go the next step, which John Locke will, of the contract theory, which would say, and of course Locke comes along about 100 years later, but Locke will argue that that authority that's entrusted to the ruler is revocable, which is to say that if the ruler is not up to snuff, mm-hmm. then the people can remove that authority from him. And how that's done, Locke never gets around to say. Ultimately, we know from our own experience in the United States, it's done through revolution, and then later on, with the Constitution, it's done through periodic elections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but here you have a 16th century saint, Saint Robert Bellarmine, who's looking at the relationship between God, the people, democracy, and rulers, just rulers. You know, it's kind of an interesting sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. He is the, it's incredible, he is the spiritual director, okay, to St. Aloysius Gonzaga.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Isn't that something? Huh. He also uses his influence at court in order to assist St. Francis de Sales. And later on, he's going to be probably best known, with his involvement as one of the judges at the Galileo trial.
Oh, okay.
And oftentimes, you'll see in popular history and in movies and things like that, these trials are a contest of mind and will between Robert Bellarmine and Galileo Galilei. But in actuality, that's a stereotype. You look at the actual transcripts and what transpired, and you find that Robert Bellarmine had great respect for Galileo, who, by the way, was a Jesuit educated,
mm-hmm.
and and that he was a moderating voice on that tribunal.
Okay.
You know, so anyway, that's something to keep in mind, and we'll take a look at Galileo a little bit later on down the line when we start looking at the church and science and all. There's one other contemporary a Jesuit that we need to take a look at also, and that's a Polish novice, Stanislaus Kostka. You don't have to have a long life to make a great impact. Stanislaus was joined the Jesuits. He was sent to Vienna to study. He became quite ill there, and eventually, when he got better, he was then sent down to Rome, where the climate's a little bit more comfortable and warmer. And in 1567, he was formally received into the Jesuits as a 17-year-old youth. His holiness and devotion and sincerity and love of God as a novice just inspired so many, everyone around him, that when he died 1 year later at the age of 18, everyone knew that they had been living in the midst of a saint.
Wow.
You know, most of the time when you think about the novitiate like sort of prepares you for the spiritual life.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was living the spiritual life in that novitiate.
At 17.
Yeah, 17. He dies at the age of 18 mm-hmm. years old. There was one other saint who was living during this time who is quite extraordinary, and his life will remind us of the challenge that and the struggle that's taking place in the Mediterranean between Christianity and Islam, and his name is Benedict the Moor. His nickname is the Moor. He's not actually a Moor.
Mm-hmm.
What he is an Ethiopian.
Oh, okay.
And it's really fascinating. His life is fascinating. His parents were both slaves from Ethiopia, and they had been brought to Sicily. Now, you have to constantly keep in mind that, you know, as Americans talk and use the word slavery, our understanding of slavery is this, well, under any circumstance, slavery is a terrible institution, but our understanding of slavery is the worst of the worst,
right,
in which people are not even treated as people, they're treated as things,
mm-hmm.
and bought and sold and have no rights. This isn't true of Spanish-style slavery. Slavery among the Spanish was closer to like indentured servants,
mm-hmm.
and there were possibilities, especially after conversion, possibilities of buying your own freedom, of being freed, and that sort of thing. And this was true of Benedict's parents, and so they eventually gained their own freedom. They stayed in Sicily. And he himself, they're living in a small town. It's San Philadelphio, and he was born in 1526. He is very early on attracted to the life of hermits who are living around that area, and eventually he joins these hermits and helps to organize them under a Franciscan rule. They're not Franciscans, but
mm-hmm.
they're living an independent life, but he organizes them around the Franciscan rule, and they elect him their superior. And he stayed the superior of this group of hermits for 22 years.
Wow.
That's something. Eventually, the order died out, and with that, he was invited to join the regular Franciscans.
Okay.
Which he does, and moves to Palermo, where he is elected the superior there, and spends basically the remainder of his life reforming the Franciscan house at Palermo, and then living a good and holy life, influencing the people of the area, and especially the Franciscans themselves. And in 1589, he dies, and is immediately nicknamed Benedict the Moor, and simply because he's Black African,
mm-hmm.
and but I think his official title is Saint Benedict of San Filadelfano, or Philadelphia, is canonized in 1807, which is an interesting thing that happens. It's around that time. This is 1807.
Uh-huh.
And it's around that time that a number of European powers are beginning to recognize the scourge of slavery and taking action to stop it. The British have recently, around that, this is about 1805, I think, had announced what they call the Orders in Council, in which they gave permission to British warships to stop slaving ships and to return the slaves to Africa. The French will begin moving in that same direction. Of course, we in the United States are going to hold off for many, many years on that. But here you have a case in which the Vatican very clearly states its own interest in recognizing black Africans as being having all the same dignity as any other human being, and going on record. Later on, Pope Gregory in the 1830s and 40s will make those statements even more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But Saint Benedict is a great example of the Church of all nations and all races. You know.
Great.
So that's Saint Benedict. But not too far away from him is the island of Malta.
Okay.
And we're going to be seeing that Malta plays a very, very important role in this great struggle that's going on between Christians, especially in Western and Central Mediterranean, and then the Ottoman Turks, who are really forcing their way across North Africa. Of course,
mm-hmm.
That's all Muslim territory, but also making lots of raids along the Spanish coastline, even in southern France, Italy, Sicily. There are, you know, this is sort of an untold story, but there are lots of raids. There are lots of Christians living along the coastlines who are abducted and go into slavery or brought into Turkish slavery and never see their homes again. Many people killed. There's a lot of terrible stuff going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this. I guess we could mention also that, one of the things that's important in recognizing this is that from a Christian point of view, the Western Mediterranean is always questionable whether or not it's going to, it's dangerous. It is dangerous to live along the coast, and it's always questionable. We've had in our own American experience the Barbary pirates. Those guys have been around for 500, 600 years, and this was always a difficulty. So it's really going to be a question of who controls the central Mediterranean as to whether or not Christianity is going to be able to flourish in this area that Christianity had been in, of course, since the time of Christ. Along with the Barbary pirates, you always also have up in Spain itself the possibilities of a fifth column with the Moriscos. These are Moors, Muslims who had converted to Christianity at the time of the conquest of Granada. Yeah. By the way, I want to say something about that too. I was just doing some reading. I'd mentioned to you earlier that I was reading Philip Kamen's book on the Spanish Empire,
mm-hmm.
and I came across something that that gave me a real insight into this Crusader tax that we had talked about with Martin Luther.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I think I had misspoken myself, because and every other historian that I've ever read has done the same thing, pointing out that the Crusader tax was never used for Crusades, but the money was used to build St. Peter's in Rome. But what I discovered through Kamen's book, and I looked up his sources, and he's got good scientific sources, is that in fact 50% of the expenses paid in the Reconquista of Granada was paid for by papal funds.
Right.
So in fact, the Crusader taxes were being used. Yeah, that's a real correction on my part.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I'm happy to see the money was being used the way it was supposed
exactly.
to be. I just wish that the Germans who were objecting to the tax had known and realized that.
Right.
In fact, a significant number of troops in that siege of Grenada were not Spanish. There were a good number of German and Italian, and I think also English, fighting for Ferdinand and Isabella.
All right.
So a little bit of a little fun fact that's good to know. We'll be looking at the siege of Malta in 1565. It's just an incredible story. In fact, there's just recently a movie has been made of it. It's a 90 minute docudrama on the siege of Malta.
Oh, really?
I just found it on the internet the other day, and I want to see how I can get a copy of it, because that'd be really fascinating stuff. I remember as a kid reading a history of the siege of Malta, and after I put the thing down, I thought to myself, wow, what a movie that thing would be. You know? Well, somebody finally got around to do it. Yeah. Well, to see the length and the bitterness of the struggle, we have to go back all the way to 1453.
Okay.
And that's the year. 1453 is the year that the Ottoman Turks come surging out of Asia Minor, and they take over the city of Constantinople.
Okay.
That will be the fall now of the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, 1453. When that happens, all of southeastern Europe now is exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to set things up for the continual fighting between Christians and Muslims in, what used to be Yugoslavia. All of that has its roots all the way back into that time. A lot of this is going to be dominated by the reign of a very powerful personality, Suleiman II.
Mm-hmm.
He's known in history as Suleiman the Magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a force to reckon with. The Ottoman Turks are at their height in power. They're spreading very rapidly, and part of that is spreading up into Hungary. I mentioned earlier on about Lawrence of Brindisi saving Hungary in 1601, 1602, but later on, Suleiman is going to come back again and is... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm misspeaking myself. I'm a century off.
Okay.
Suleiman had conquered Hungary. Later on, the Hungarians will free themselves, and then Lawrence of Brindisi will come in to help. But as early as 1521, the city of Belgrade had been taken by the Ottoman Turks.
Wow.
And in 1526, the Hungarian army, the Christian army, was absolutely crushed.
1526.
Wow. Yeah. There something like 20,000 Christian infantry, along with 4,000 cavalry, were all slaughtered.
Wow.
at a big battle of Mohacs.
Wow.
Later on, Vienna itself will come under siege in 1529. So, and then as we go into the next century, as I say, this is going to be a continuing battle. People like Lawrence of Brindisi, John of Capistrano is also going to defend Belgrade also.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So we have all of this happening up in the Balkans area, up in southeast Europe. Along the Mediterranean, the same thing is also happening. A huge army is landed at the island of Rhodes, which is in the eastern Mediterranean. And eventually it's taken by siege. This is in 1522. So all this is happening. This is 5 years after Martin Luther nails the 95 theses.
Right.
All this is happening as part of the backdrop of what we're all concentrating on Western Europe and the Reformation, but all of this is happening at the same time. The Sultan lands some 90,000 soldiers on the island of Rhodes. And along with that, some 400 ships.
400 ships.
400 ships. The defenders were made up of a handful of militia from the island of Rhodes, a couple thousand militia, and they had 7,000 knights.
Oh.
That was it.
Just been 90,000
against
400.
But these were famed knights. These are the Knights of Rhodes.
Okay.
And this is the same order that's going to change its name a couple times. And it's good for us to take a quick look at this group. They're also known as the Hospitallers.
The Hospitallers.
The Hospitallers. They were founded during the time of the Crusades.
Okay.
Okay. They were founded by a knight named Gerard, and then later a co-founder, the second Grand Master, Raymond of Provence, a French nobleman, around 1150, really gives a dimension to this group. Now, what they are they're noblemen.
Okay.
They are soldiers. They're knights, and they provide hotels or hostelries. That's where the word comes from. It doesn't come from hospital,
uh-huh.
but it comes from hospitality.
Uh-huh.
And they provide hospitia, mm-hmm. okay, which are like little hostels where pilgrims could come and stay on their pilgrimages to and from the Holy Land. And they'll provide protection for them because this was dangerous times back then. It's still dangerous times, isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
right.
Here we are in 2003, mm-hmm. and not many people even want to go to the Holy Land. It is just so dangerous. Well, it was dangerous back then, too. And so this particular order will provide help for people as they travel.
Now, are these the Knights Templar?
No.
No, okay.
They're
because is that not what the Templars did as
yes,
well in the beginning
right.
was to
yeah.
ensure safety as people traveled?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And there are several religious orders that
okay.
are military orders, and this is only going to be one of them.
Okay,
yeah.
okay.
And that's a good point. I'm glad you mentioned the Templars. The Templars, of course, are known as Templars because their headquarters is on Temple Mount.
Right.
The Hospitallers are known as Hospitallers because of the hospitality
okay.
that they're famous for.
And the Templars were more almost money keepers too, right? For the
and so
the banking
the Hospitallers.
System.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, the Hospitallers are too.
Are too. Yeah.
Okay.
All of them will get into this. But yeah, you're right. The and the Templars are probably they're like a couple stages ahead of the Hospitallers
okay.
moving in that direction.
Okay.
They're the ones that, yeah, they're set up specifically for military purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, Gerard's idea of the Hospitallers was to be armed, but basically to be infirmarians,
okay.
sort of. Okay.
okay.
As time goes on, history moves the Hospitallers in such a way that they find themselves more involved in the military side
mm-hmm.
than on the hotel side.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, and the two orders will fight side by side throughout the Crusades. Both of these orders are held in the highest esteem. And as one historian said, that when the Templars are in the advanced troops, the Hospitallers act as the rear guard, and when the Templars are in the rear guard, the Hospitallers are in the advanced troops. They are the shock troops, the special forces of the Crusades.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? There are three kinds of members of three areas of this order. It's also known as the Order of St. John.
Oh, okay.
Around 1200. And it takes more and more military, after around 1200, it takes on more and more of a military apostolate, if you could say. there are three kinds of brothers. You have the military brothers.
Okay.
These are knights, soldiers,
mm-hmm.
fighters. Okay. Then there's another group, the infirmarian brothers.
Okay.
And these are really the ones that take care of the hostelries. They'll also act as infirmarians for people who are ill while they're traveling.
Okay.
And then there's another third element, and those are the chaplains.
Okay.
And these are priests. These are ordained priests in that order, and they do not take up the sword.
Okay.
Okay. But they'll take care of the spiritual needs of the other brothers. Okay. Well, things begin changing. After the fall of the Holy Land, when the Muslims come back and take over the Holy Land, And then especially after the fall of the fortress at Acre in 1291, the knights themselves, the Knights of St. John, who are nicknamed the Hospitallers, withdraw from the Holy Land and instead take up their position in Cyprus, where they'll remain, another island, where they'll remain for a short while, and then they will be given the task of conquering Rhodes, the island of Rhodes, which they do. And then having done that, they then make Rhodes their headquarters.
Okay.
So that's how they become known as the Knights of Rhodes.
Okay.
And, of course, this is the group of knights who are defending Rhodes against these 90,000 Turks that are attacking. In 1522, a huge attack, and it ends up being a siege that goes on for 6 months.
Longer than I would have assumed.
Yeah, well, longer than the Turks would have assumed. I mean, Solomon the Magnificent thought he was going to just magnificently walk through
this. Run over.
It didn't. What happened was that the knights took as many people as they could possibly get and brought them into the fortresses, and not only the people, but also brought in all the supplies they could. And before anyone thought of scorched earth warfare, this is exactly what they did. They took all the animals, all the food, anything that was usable. So that meant that the Turks had to send all the way back to Greece and to Turkey in order to get provisions. So they were constantly providing for the troops, those 90,000 troops on the island of Rhodes. And the Christians were all bundled up into their fortress and, of course, eating all of the supplies. But after 6 months, they ran out. And they were reduced. The walls were rubble. They were reduced. And with that, the knights then sent word to Suleiman and offered to surrender. Suleiman the Magnificent, he earns that title. He says to the knights, he said, "You guys fought like I couldn't believe. I just couldn't believe that 7,000 of you could hold back 90,000 of my men. I'm going to accept your surrender, and you're free to go." And the knights go, "Well, that's nice, but you destroyed all our ships. We can't leave. It's an island." And he goes, "Oh, well, you can borrow mine." Believe it or not, he gathered all the knights and anyone else on Rhodes who wanted to leave, and he shipped them off to Western Europe, to Christian Europe, as a sign of his admiration for the fighting ability of this order of knights.
Amazing. I was just waiting for for the blow. Wow.
Yeah. Once they get back to Europe, the Emperor Charles V then gives them the assignment of guarding Rhodes. Of guarding Malta.
Okay.
So now the Knights of St. John, who are nicknamed the Hospitallers, who became the Knights of Rhodes, are now in Malta.
Malta,
which
okay.
They'll, of course, now become known as the Knights of Malta.
Okay.
But it's not much. I mean,
there's not much left.
One of the things about these knights is they learned, being now islanders, they learned how to sail and fight on ships.
Okay.
And so they're really quite expert at that. But they didn't have a lot of money. They had been pretty beaten back by this time. And so they only had 7 galleys. That was their fleet. But Malta is an incredibly strategic spot. It's located halfway between, imagine the Mediterranean, long, and halfway in between the Mediterranean is this huge boot that comes down. That's Italy. And it's kicking a flattened soccer ball, which is Sicily. And just below that is Malta, which is halfway between Sicily and North Africa.
Okay.
That's a very, very vital naval spot. And these 7 galleys then are used by the Knights of Malta to sail around that part of the Mediterranean to keep piracy down.
Oh, okay.
You know, because there's a lot of pirates, and especially the Barbary pirates. At the same time, after the siege of Malta, it's great heyday, The order itself went into something of a decline. And the reason for that is that it was, while it was no longer militarily powerful, it still was commercially powerful. And so although members of the Knights had taken the power of poverty, it's once again, it's personal poverty, not corporate poverty. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the corporation was quite wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the 1200s, historians tell us that there were over 19,000 manors all throughout Europe owned by these Knights.
Wow.
You know, these are not monasteries. These are nice places. And so there's a... And as a result of that, there's a decline in... Well, poverty has never been a real big deal
uh-huh.
with these guys to begin with. First of all, they're all noblemen.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
They're kind of used to the good life. And so their notion of poverty is a little bit different than the Franciscan notion of poverty, obviously. Added to that is they're spending so much time and energy on military matters that they begin neglecting their prayer life, prayer in common, their devotions. And with that, there's a relaxation in these manners and a relaxation to the point of while they have a vow of celibacy, they interpret that as not marrying, as nothing to do with women. And
okay.
Remember, they're soldiers, and they're in garrison and all that. In fact, at one point, one of the generals of the order is actually imprisoned by his brother, brothers,
okay.
Brother religious, because he tried to enforce the celibacy rule on them.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And at the same time, the other great vow, of course, is obedience. And one would think they're a bunch of soldiers, they'd be obedient. But the reality is that many of them were very independent-minded fellows. And when they received the rank of a commandery of one of these manors, basically after that, they didn't have to answer to anybody, including the general. And they kind of ignored the Pope, and so this is an order that, having fought so well and magnificently on Rhodes, by the time it's assigned to Malta, is just sort of there. Now it survived. The Knights Templar had been gone for a number of centuries. Most of the other military religious orders were gone, so it still is there, but its finest hour is about to happen.
Okay,
you know. And you have to remember that this is a group of men who are not particularly on fire with fervor, but when push comes to shove, they're going to be there at their finest.
Okay.
Yeah. You know? And the challenge comes from the challenge is going to come from once again the Ottoman Empire. This is later on. In 1565, there's going to be a gathering of an army and a navy that's going to move again to take the central Mediterranean. The Christians knew, the Knights knew from their own spies, that this army was being assembled in the east, and this navy was being assembled. The Grand Master at the time was a man by the name of de Valette, and he sent word to all of the monarchs of Europe, all the Christian monarchs of Europe, asking for help, because he knew that Malta was going to be a target for this attack. It didn't look good.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, France was very cool on the notion. Part of the reason was that they were quietly pro-Ottoman Turk.
That's right. Okay.
England, of course, is Protestant. Germany is a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Only Spain could be counted on, and yet even then, by now, the King of Spain is Philip II, who is a great procrastinator. He just diddles away until he finally makes a decision, which is half the time a wrong decision. And in fact, what he does with with Malta is going to be a wrong decision that will be corrected by one of his underlings.
Ah, okay.
The viceroy of Sicily is going to save the day, but that's another story. And then, of course, as you look to Italy, another Catholic country, there is no such country as Italy at the time. It's a bunch of little countries. And even there are only two countries in Italy that were even interested in trying to help, one of those being Venice and the other one being the Papal States.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them are too weak to do much anyway. Well, right away, the knights on Malta start looking around at Malta trying to figure out what to do, and they use the same tactics that they did with Rhodes. They began bringing everybody they could into the capital, Medina. And luckily, the capital has a grand harbor. It's a complex of grand harbor, and it has three fortifications.
Okay.
And the most important of which is St. Elmo.
Oh, okay.
So they're going to put a lot of their forces there at St. Elmo. And on May 18th of 1565, Suleiman the Magnificent's army arrives.
Okay.
And it is an army of some 38,000. They're going to attack St. Elmo, which has a garrison of 100 knights of Malta and 500 infantry. It doesn't look good.
Okay, it's an army of
38,000.
And attacking?
600.
600.
Yeah.
And
Of the 600, 500 of them are lightly armed. There are only 100, heavily armored knights. The first assault takes place on June 3rd. And the Sultan's troops use, first of all, the Janissaries. Now, this is an elite guard of the Sultan's own guard. This is the finest soldiers they have. It's made up of the sons of Christians who are under Turkish rule. So they've got a real good reason to fight hard, because if they don't fight hard, their families can be slaughtered.
Okay. Right?
So they've got a real good reason to fight. And so they attack St. Elmo. And as the battle goes back and forth, a few of the knights are killed. In that first attack, that first day, 2,000 Turks are killed in this first assault. Later on, after several other attempts, on June 10th of 1565, another assault is made, this time at night.
Mm-hmm.
And firebombs are catapulted into St. Elmo. About 1,500 more Ottoman Turks die. The Christians lose very few. On the 16th of June, the Turks now are getting kind of desperate. They need to get in there and take St. Elmo. And what happens is that they begin by taking the first wave of troops, and they give them drugs to make them crazy.
Okay.
I mean, that's pretty desperate.
Yeah.
And so they get them all worked up, and then they send them in this wild wave, which, of course, I mean, you know, being drugged is not the best way to go into battle. And so they were just slaughtered.
Okay.
Yeah. Following immediately behind them are a bunch of whirling dervishes. Remember the dervishes?
These are
Turks who turn in circles. And,
And
they literally put themselves into a trance.
Okay.
Well, that's what this group was doing, and they went in, but I guess they were dizzy, and they got mowed down, and then the Janissaries go in, and then they fail. But there has been tremendous bombardment of St. Elmo, and at this point, there are only 50 knights left. Many of the militia had been killed off. Of the 100 knights, now 50 of them are still among the walking wounded, and they are facing almost certain death.
Mm-hmm.
Late one night, 300 volunteers snuck into St. Elmo to join them. They knew that they were going to die. They knew it. And yet they went in to join the knights. Day after day, fight. After day, attacks on the walls. The Turks even had, besides their other artillery, they had a specially made giant cannon. And this thing fired off, it could only fire about once a day, fired off a huge ball. It was a solid piece of marble. And this thing would lob through the air and smash against St. Elmo's walls and just literally shatter the walls. And then it would roll back down the hill. And then later at night, the Turks would run and they would get some of their soldiers. And they would literally take this thing and roll it back up to their lines and then fire it off again. They only had two or three marbles. Literally, it's a giant marble weighing hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So this continued on, just reducing the fort, and until it got to the point where the knights were literally standing side by side. The account I remember, I'll never forget this as a kid, the account I read said that they would stand side by side at arm's length.
Okay.
And with their two-edged swords, these huge broadswords, they would just be fighting all day long. And when they got tired, they're hacking at Turks, attacking them. And when they got tired, they would give a signal, and another knight would come up and take their place, and they'd go back and rest, and then they'd get back into it again. At one point, there were only two captains, knights, left. And these two captains were both wounded. And so they had the other knights take them to a part of the wall which had been breached, you know, it had been fallen down. They put them on chairs, and they fought in a sitting position. This was this desperate.
Oh, my God.
It was that desperate. The garrison fought to death to the very last man. And the day before the garrison fell, they had a fire in the chapel in which they took everything that was religious and they burned it so that it wouldn't be taken by the Turks and used and abused. St. Elmo now falls. There are two other fortresses remaining. And in mid-August, a few reinforcements arrived. 46 knights who had not been on Malta at the time were able to sneak through the Turkish lines and join their brother knights. Now, these 46, I mean, personally, I think I would probably say, oh, well, I guess I didn't make it. Yeah, I'll say a prayer, I'll light a candle for you guys. But no, they went and joined their knights with the sure and certain belief that they're going to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they joined their knights, and then also some 600 Spanish troops were snuck in from the island of Sicily. Philip II had spent several weeks while the siege was going on thinking about whether he should send reinforcements in. And finally, he sent word from Madrid to the nearest Spanish forces, which is the viceroy of Sicily, and he said, "Don't send anyone. Don't send anyone." And the viceroy went ahead and sent 600 troops anyway. And this is the governor, the viceroy of Sicily. His name is Garcia de Toledo, and his defiance of his own king is incredibly important. If Malta had fallen, who knows what would have happened? Even Queen Elizabeth had said that if Malta had fallen, all of Western Christendom would have been endangered. So anyway, that's what happens.
Wow.
And so the reinforcements arrived just in time. But now there's another battle going on. There are two fortresses left, San Angelo and St. Michael's.
Okay.
And in one of those fortresses, the Turks send in miners, and they dig a tunnel underneath the fortress itself, and they put explosives there. And one day, then they literally blew up a whole wall.
Wow.
Just boom, there it went. As a result of that, the general of the Knights of Malta rally everyone around him. This is General Lavalette.
Okay.
His his courage and his rally saves Malta. And in fact, the city, the capital city of Malta, is renamed La Valette after him, in honor of him. He repulses, he and his knights repulse 11 attacks,
wow,
one after another. And finally, de Toledo, the governor of Sicily, is able to sneak 10,000 Spanish troops onto the island, everybody that he had available. The Turks took one look at these 10,000 Spanish. They probably thought, wow, I mean, if 100 knights
can do this
to us, I don't want to see what these Spanish can do. And so at that point, they got on their ships and they went back to Turkey.
Wow.
30,000 casualties. 30,000 Turkish casualties.
30,000.
Yeah.
Off from what we started with, the small little army. We started with 600 at St. Elmo's, right?
St. Elmo's had 600.
And then we've snuck in small amounts.
Yeah. I mean, when you're looking at it, we're talking about 38,000 total troops.
Right, to start with, and they left.
And they left 30,000 dead and wounded. So they went, when they left with less than 10,000 troops.
Wow.
And they had arrived with almost 40,000. This siege of Malta is absolutely incredible. It is undoubtedly the Knights of Malta's finest hour.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, they are nicknamed the Knights of Malta. They will continue as an order until 1805, when under Napoleon, they're suppressed. And they're reestablished again in 1879 by Pope Leo XIII. And they're with us today,
mm-hmm.
The Knights of Malta. It is a very proud prestigious
mm-hmm.
order, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you see, like, at great visits, like, you know, when we had the papal visit here in St.
Right.
Louis.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, uh-huh. You know, we're all, everyone's impressed. I mean, when you have so many of these orders coming in with their different habits and everything and the regalia of the Catholic Church, when you see those Knights of Malta, remember the history of these knights. They just have a tremendous history, and they still do wonderful good. They're not out, you know, using swords anymore, but they do
right.
wonderful good for the Church.
Great story, Father.
Now, we're going to have to hold off, I think, and talk about the Battle of Lepanto
later on. Well, matter of fact, I forgot to watch the clock, and we're way over time.
Oh, my goodness.
So, can we just end with a quick prayer then?
Yeah, glory be to the Father, to the Son, to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
Amen.